ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When he finished high school, David Goodwin started a uni degree, and to support himself, he took a job at a local servo in Werribee, outside of Melbourne. David took the graveyard shift and figured he'd somehow squeeze his uni course in around it, but that's not what happened. Instead, David ended up working for years from a cage in a halogen-lit palace, loaded up with chocolate bars and chips and fridges full of energy drinks. A way station for taxi drivers, drunk and spaced-out partygoers and shift workers, people who were crazy but harmless, and others who were not so harmless. This was David's first proper grown-up job, and working in this servo, he writes, was like living on a desolate alien moon in a galaxy far, far away. And it changed him from a naive and shy person into someone more street smart, more worldly. But it thwarted any decent ambition he had for his life at the time, and it took him years to find his way out. David Goodwin's memoir is called Servo, Tales from the Graveyard Shift. Just a heads up, if you've got kids around, this is a conversation that will have stories about various kinds of drug use. Hello, David.
G'day.
What do you think the significance is of the servo in general as an Australian institution?
I think when we look at the servo, you look at its name and, you know, the servo, it's part of our beloved O-suffixed vernacular. You know, you've got an avo and a garbo.
Bottle-o.
And this arvo and going down to fill up at the servo. So in that sense, it's definitely very Australian. There's something like 20 million cars on our roads, so there's a servo on every second corner, and I don't know, you look at it as an Australian institution, and it's a place where every single person of every socioeconomic background and gender and age and everything congregates in the one place. It's an inextricable part of Australia.
It's not a happy place by and large.
It's a Wild West saloon in many ways, and you never know who's going to come in those doors. You don't even know what you're going to get from the console operator. They could be very sleep deprived and in a really interesting kind of mood. And yeah, you don't know what you're going to get from the shelves, especially that deli fridge. Yeah, it's a mystery.
How different is the daytime servo from the graveyard shift servo?
It is night and day. It is a different solar system. I work during the day, not very often, but sometimes. And obviously it's busier during the day, so you don't really have a lot of time to think during the day, but you're pretty much just, you're an automaton during the day, and you're saying, you know, tap your card, and well, back then it was scan your card, but now it's all tap, which would be much better. But yeah, you're just, you know, you're scanning the forecourt for drive-offs, you're nervous, you're busy, your amygdala's going mental, and you're just trying to keep up. But at night, you are a lot more watchful, you're a lot more thoughtful, and, you know, so are people. But there's something about the night that it changes people. It softens them, but it lowers their inhibitions. But it also breeds a very distinct flavor of madness, quite frankly. And you never know when that's going to strike.
I've gone in there late at night at times, and just looking back, and I can remember seeing people wandering about from aisle to aisle who are either really intoxicated on one thing or another. They're there when I walk in, and they're there still trying to figure out what they want when they walk out. Can people spend a long time just sort of drifting around the aisles, not really doing anything?
Eons. Like, when you're behind the counter, time slows down by another 7 degrees, and you are just standing there either reading the same passage out of an article from The Age, and you're just like, for sake, will you hurry up and grab your cherry ripe or your pie or your bottle of Coke or whatever? I mean, it took me probably 5 years to actually get to a point where I was okay with it. And sometimes you would rather something happen, even if it's bad, just because it would bring some kind of denouement and they would get the hell out of the store. But people are relaxed at night, like I said, and their inhibitions are lowered, so they just take their time.
Do people ever come up to you and offer to trade things for fuel instead of money for all sorts of things?
Yes. So I had a barbecue chicken pizza that was lukewarm and had one slice missing. This was with a woman who couldn't pay for her petrol.
She offered you a barbecue chicken pizza with one slice missing.
And was quite perturbed when I turned it down. She was
Are you crazy?
This is a great deal. Yeah. What are you thinking? Palm readings.
Drugs as well? People offer drugs?
God, every third night, I think. I worked weekend nights primarily. And, the drug dealers were a part of my clientele. They were everywhere. It was probably about a year in when I first started to get interested because I was like, well, you know, I've got 2.5 ton of stock to put away tonight and I've got, you know, hundreds of customers to serve and I've got uni in the morning and I'm not going to sleep. So this could work.
I've got a friend whose husband for some years worked at a servo in Bathurst, and years later he saw one of the most seriously crazy regular customers working as a duty manager in a major urban inner-city McDonald's. Have you had that experience of running into a former servo habitué out in the real world afterwards?
A couple, yeah. What's really interesting is there are 3 or 4 people I know of that went and did other things but then went back and are now still working for the same company. So it does surprise you, but then I suppose it's not familiarity breeds contempt. It's almost like familiarity breeds loyalty in a kind of Stockholm syndrome way. And they're like, God, I hate my job, but they give everything to it. I just don't think console operators are appreciated enough for what they deal with, because there's something about servos. When you look at retail, you look at all different kinds of retail, and there is no other kind of retail institution that I can think of where people will act that way, where you need anti-jump wire strung cage with a locked door and a security pendant around your neck and the cops on speed dial sometimes during the day. Doesn't happen in a supermarket. You know, there's so many places and they're all generally civil, but there's something about servos. Maybe it's to do with a mixture of road rage and high petrol prices. And so they're angry before they walk in the door. But yeah, there's just this undercurrent of rage that is almost yearning for a kind of release. It's like there's gas floating down the aisles and there are sparks that are blown in through the automatic doors and then it's just blooming flame.
Were you writing this book while you're on your shifts or after your shifts or years later after you left the job?
All three, but primarily in between customers. So the majority of the book was scrawled on long white snakes of register receipt paper.
Is that so you looked like you were working?
No, it was just, as a writer, you just want to capture the intensity of the scene in the most visceral way. And when I'm in the moment, I can write it quite well. When I'm remembering, I can still do it, but it lacks something. And yeah, quite frankly, if it's 3 a.m., it gives you something to do. But you're either a writer or you're not. And you either look at something and go, oh, wow, that's fascinating, I've got to write that down. Or, oh, that's interesting. I think also maybe in a deeper psychological sense, I wasn't as concerned because I was fascinated.
Like I said, you wrote that you were quite a naive, slightly lazy guy, shy before you started working at the servo. It was your first proper grown-up job. What did you want to do with your life at that point?
I wanted to be a writer. Obviously, the servo was just for money while I was at uni. I was doing a professional writing degree at Deakin University. And that's always what I wanted to be since I was about 10 years old. And as you may have heard, you know, people will say, write what you know. I was a shy, naive kid and I didn't know anything. I hadn't seen the world. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a car. I didn't have my freaking license. So
you couldn't be Kerouac and jump into a car and drive across Australia.
And he was my hero. Like, he was my favorite writer back then, funnily enough. So I read On the Road and I was just transfixed and I thought, this is what I want to do.
Got as far as the servo.
Exactly. I was the antithesis of the road. You know, I was where the road ends.
But every kind of human being comes into a servo. That's the thing. And they come in their most outrageous plumage on the graveyard shift. What was the job application process like?
It started with my mum saying, get a freaking job. Mm. And, you know, I was looking online and I kept seeing this name, console operator, and I thought, I have no idea what that is, except for Homer's role at the nuclear power plant. So I thought, I'll click and I'll see what it is. And that was the first one I clicked on and showed up to the interview in jeans and this horrible, ill-fitting shirt that I don't even think I buttoned up properly. The manager, who was the guy who ended up being my actual retail area manager, was the most downtrodden, sleep-deprived person I had seen in all of my years. And he was like the night retail manager. So anyway, he interviewed me, shook my hand and, you know, just had rows of suitcases under his eyes. And yeah, he didn't really seem too fussed. And he said, yep, okay, yep, this is the job. Do you want it? I said, oh, yeah, okay, cool.
And what kind of training did you get?
I had a week at a suburban servo where we worked during the day, 9 to 5. It was quite a busy servo, and I'd say every 30 to 50 customers, you'd get someone come in and scream and threaten you and often throw things at you. So that was kind of the baptism of fire that I was like, okay, this is part of the deal. We'll see how I go.
So after a week, they then dropped you in the deep end. You went on a graveyard shift.
Yeah, on my own. My boss actually called me up that night when I'd finished my training, and he said, can you do a shift for me tomorrow? I said, yeah, no worries. He goes, all right, you start in 4 hours. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, oh, 1 a.m. tomorrow. That was the real baptism of fire. That was sort of inner west of Melbourne. And that was ice addicts, heroin addicts. That was chaos. It was a elongated 8 hours of unremitting chaos. It's difficult to even know where to begin with that shift. It's a cliche, but every single thing that you could possibly fathom that could go wrong in that time frame went wrong right on schedule. It piled up and piled up and piled up, and the anxiety and the fear and not knowing what to do and not knowing who to call. And that's the thing, when you work nights and servo, there's not really many people to call. It's assumed that you know what you're doing, but with a week of training that was generally woefully inadequate, you just thrown in and said, off you go.
How old were you?
I was 20 years old.
Then you shifted very soon after to a servo in your home suburb of Werribee, which is located pretty equidistantly between Melbourne and Geelong, famous for having the sewage treatment works. And you were put in this console, as you say, in this servo. This is a kind of a cage, isn't it? What is this console? What is this space you've got to dwell in when you're doing this job?
Yeah, the console, I mean, it's quite utilitarian in a sense. I mean, everything is there where it should be, as you need it. But it's foreboding in a different way because servos are so unrelentingly intense. I think everyone knows this in their subconscious. You walk in the door and you've got this intense bath of halogen bouncing off these nuclear intense colors of products that are got huge amounts of salt, sugar, and caffeine. And the color is almost belligerent. And you're just going, this is intense. Then you've got the sound. You've got the beeping of the console. You've got the slamming of fridge doors. You've got the drone of all the humming fridges and freezers and slurpy machines. And you're just like, everything's turned up to 17. And you just often, like I go into them these days, not as often as I used to. And I'm floored for a second. And I walk up and I'm like, oh, whoa. So, I mean, when you're in one for 8 hours, that's going to do something interesting to your psyche. And when you're in one for 10 years, 15,000 hours roughly, I counted recently, that's how much I've done. And I think it was Malcolm Gladwell that said 10,000 hours will give you mastery in a topic. So
you're as good as you're ever going to be at that kind of job, in other words.
Well, I don't think I ever really put in to be the best console operator, but I suppose it depends how you judge it.
Now, you have control of the auto doors late night.
You do. And some people go on a bit of a power trip because they can lock them you're supposed to lock them. So I think it was 8 p.m., depending, maybe it was summer and winter, it changed a bit. But I think after that, the doors had to be locked, no exceptions. And you had to, technically, no one ever really did this, but you had to have the door locked. And if someone showed up, you had to physically inspect them on a screen and then say, okay, they're okay to, you know, unlock the door for them.
And when they're not okay, what do? You just don't open the door?
No, you don't unlock the door.
And then they're a bit angry about that, I assume.
They bang on the door and they threaten you and then they... But I let everyone in. I don't think I ever didn't let anyone in, sometimes to my definite detriment. But some rules are just not really achievable. Like, it's all well and good to write a memo when you're sitting in an office, but, you know, when you're doing the thing and when you're in the front lines, the trenches of retail, as I call it, it's often about people management. It's about not pissing that massive, burly, tattooed guy who's on ice off once you realize he's on ice when he's inside, because anything could happen.
You tear up the whole store, yeah. So you're sitting in this console behind anti-jump wires, like you say.
I wish.
Oh, standing.
I'm standing on my very inadequate contoured anti-fatigue mat. just staring out into the kaleidoscopic void
of like electric green V drinks.
Yep.
And you've got an emergency pendant around your neck and the police on speed dial. What kind of protection do you have against something like armed robbery, for example?
Nothing. I mean, beyond that locked door. But obviously, you know, the time, generally, if someone's intelligent, they're probably not going to, you know, I don't know, actually. I mean, I was never robbed when I was working in the server. But then I went to Europe for about 6 months, came back and got a job again for my sins in another server for about the same time, 5 or 6 years. And I was robbed in that place. But it was a very unorthodox situation. It was by a guy who actually used to work there and then went off the deep end and was into all sorts of deep conspiracies. And he came in with a crowbar, but I was in the fridge stocking drinks. And I came back out carrying these empty boxes and I went, what the hell's going on? There's a guy by the console. And he got the crowbar out. We watched on video afterwards to pretend that he was jimmying open the till. And then he just went to the buttons and went, doot, 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 doot. And we went, oh, that's interesting. And right. So I yelled and he ran and I chased him for a bit just on reflex. And he turned around about 50 meters and then did these weird kung fu moves. And I just cracked up laughing. And then he looked and he ran off. And anyway, the cops caught him not long after. But yeah, so that was my robbery experience.
And what are you doing when you're not in the console behind these anti-jump wires, when you're locked behind there? Is there, and there's no customers? Do you then have to go and do other work around the place?
You do, especially at night. I'd say 3 times a week you'd be getting major stock deliveries that are anywhere from 1 ton to more. So, you know, you think of all of those boxes of 2 litre Coke and Snickers and...
They're arriving on pallets, are they?
Yeah, they're drawn in on pallet jacks by always unhinged delivery drivers. There's something about a guy that delivers stock at 2 a.m. He just has to be big, hairy, in a singlet in the middle of winter and impressively unhinged. Often drug-enhanced, yes.
Yes. Have you ever been locked out of... Were you ever locked out of your console?
I was on my first ever night on my own twice in about 40 minutes. When you start working in a new store and they have a locked console door, like they most of them did back then, obviously now they all do, it obviously has a code that you have to type to get in. And the code had been written down on a scrap of paper for me by the guy who was on before me. And, you know, I was trying to remember 17 things at once, and then I left the console and the door obviously closes automatically. And then by the time I'd been in the fridge and came back, I realized that I couldn't get in to serve customers, which was a problem because I was there on my own. So what I ended up having to do was climbing over the chocolate bar shelves and the chewing gum through these tiny little gap in between the anti-jump wire, and I caught my foot on it and sort of knocked all of the promo display cases and the scanner and everything to the ground.
And was there an audience for this?
There was, unfortunately, for this. There were a few guys in the store. They were, the first time it happened, there was one guy who came in to buy smokes and he pissed himself laughing after he bought his smokes and then stayed in the store for about 5 minutes to continue laughing at me. Then he finally left and I realized that another guy had followed him in when I unlocked the door, who for some bizarre reason was my year 10 visual arts teacher.
Oh, no.
So that was confronting and I was starting to struggle. And then I did the same thing about 20 minutes later and there was a group of, they would have been drunken, sort of middle-aged men, and they'd obviously stayed up to watch a soccer match and they were pretty sozzled. They went straight to the pie warmer and ate all the pies. And then that was when I realized I'd done it again. So I had to climb over again. And they started this football. I can't remember the chant for the life of me these days, but it was specifically aimed at my own entertaining degree of incompetence. And I was just like, this is not off to a good start.
You've got an impressively diverse array of extraordinary creatures and not so extraordinary creatures that came in and out through the doors. I'd like you to read a passage from your book, if you don't mind, which describes one in any given night in the servo, the kind of people that would come through in and out of the doors.
Sure. I'd spent the day, a Friday, at uni, sleepily learning about jihadists and revolutions and was seriously struggling to stay awake, even as I rushed, yawning across the forecourt toward the store, where a group of young kids were holding a bag of goon above their heads, taking turns squirting the golden wine into their mouths. They held it high, like a shining trophy, glaring distrustfully at anyone who stepped too close. I went inside and was greeted with an angry-looking Ralph, who was raising his watch and staring at it with a look of supreme distaste, buttressed by a raft of melodramatic sighs. I was about to apologise for my 90 seconds of tardiness, but was drowned out by the sudden cries and anguish and tortured moans from just outside the store. I turned around to see the remains of the bag splayed out like a silver starfish as the wine snaked towards the petrol drain. The poor kids were in shock. Several minutes later, after Ralph had huffed off to his car, they formed a funeral line. Their faces solemn and their steps reserved, they marched past the door slowly in file, a requiem for Goon. They soon departed but were quickly replaced by a group of drunken middle-aged women on a hen's night, gorging themselves on a feast of imitation chicken burgers and firing endless party poppers at me so I was covered in long, multicoloured streamers, the smell of gunpowder drifting down the aisles. At about 1 a.m, as I was downing my second coffee, a short, shirtless man with ludicrously hairy shoulders walked into the store. A glint of metal caught the corner of my eye. He was wearing a massive gold cross on the end of an oversized gold chain. The cross was almost the size of his head, bouncing off his gut as he strutted around the store. He bought a jar of Vegemite.
That's all he wanted. Isn't that marvellous? Tell me about the gold BMW pumping out Roxette's Joyride from the car speakers one night.
It was quite emblematic of the servo experience because the whole servo experience on some nights, I would almost say more than 50% of the nights, was like you were suspended in a fluorescent Dali painting. And the surreal quality of this, something about it just shook me. So I think it was about 1:30, 2 a.m. and this was my first night of my first shift in my home suburb of Werribee. And I was thinking, I think Werribee will be a bit more normal than where I was. You know, it's a bit further away from the city, not as many weirdos maybe. And I'd already had some weird stuff happen, but then I just heard this incredibly loud music coming and I realized what it was straight away. You know, I grew up in the 80s and I knew Roxette, you know, when I heard it.
It's a very annoying song, actually.
I don't mind it. I think it's got this cinematic quality to it. It's corny, but you've got to love it for what it is. But anyway, it just filled the forecourt because it was just so enveloping. And this gold BMW was driving into the servo. And there were a couple of other people sort of milling out the front. And there was this person coming up through the open sunroof of the gold BMW with a balaclava on. And I thought, what in the hell is going on here? And they started throwing water bombs at people that were sort of on the forecourt or around. And these people came in and they said, what the? I said, I don't know. This is my first night. Don't blame me. And they found out after a while that it wasn't water, but it was different flavored cordial that apparently actually even matched the colors of the water bombs themselves. And I often think of that moment to this day, and I'm unnerved, but I'm also fascinated and impressed that they went to that much effort.
There's a fair bit of care and preparation that's gone into that little effort. And,
like, how do you get cordial and fill it up? Like, you don't have a tap of cordial. But anyway.
Every bee and fly and wasp in Werribee would have been training those poor people afterwards too. Your plan was to be doing uni while all this was going on. What happened to uni in the course of you starting to work at this servo?
So, I mean, I needed money and I wanted something that wouldn't clash with my tutorials and my lectures. And I thought, I can do night shift. I've always been a night owl and I'll get through. But I mean, this was full-time uni. But you know, the impetuousness of youth. You think, I can get away with this. I can do both.
You mentioned The Simpsons there. This is insanely replicating that episode of The Simpsons when Homer goes to work at the Quickie Mart to make money to pay for a pony for Lisa and ends up thinking, oh, I just don't need to sleep. Was that you? Did you think you'd somehow not sleep or something?
Pretty much. I thought I could get by on maybe, I thought I would get maybe a full night's sleep 3 or 4 nights a week and the others I would maybe get an hour or two and I thought I would generally be okay. I was a real night owl. Like, I was going to sleep at 3 a.m. on school nights quite often. So, I mean, it wasn't completely abnormal for me. And I think that was what kept me there in the early days when the craziness was starting to become confronting. It was like, I don't know, there's something appealing about this. The big thing for me, I think, was the coming of age that, as I said, I was painfully shy and I was terrified of confrontation and I didn't know what I wanted to be. And when you don't know what you want to be, anything that will make you something is preferable. But yeah, uni didn't last. I got kicked out the following year because of my horrific attendance and bad grades. And actually, when I handed something in, it was generally good grades, but I didn't hand many things in that second year.
Given that you wanted to be a writer, not a servo worker, why didn't you quit the job and go back to uni?
I think once I got into it, the night changes people. And I've seen this time and time again. And because I was so callow and I was so inexperienced, it was partly the customers and it was also partly a mate or two that sort of, kind of like a Pied Piper for the Children of Hamelin, kind of led me into this, say, a road to perdition, but it was into this kind of Pinocchio's Pleasure Island is a lot closer. And, you know, I was young and I wanted to have fun. I wanted to experience things. I wanted to see life from a different side. And I did. I followed my customer's tune and I got into all sorts of fun intoxicants. And it was a journey. I was Pinocchio and I saw the bright lights of Pleasure Island across the water and I thought, I want some of that. So the servo was the initiation, if you will, into that.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
People would wander in who had some mental health issues or were just being caught up in a couple of ideas that were kind of crazy. There's one guy you write about quite affectionately called Randall, who was a regular. Tell me about Randall.
Oh, Randall is, I heard the other day from actually one of my friends, this was last week, she is a psychiatric nurse and she has dealt with Randall very recently and said he's doing really well. He's got the latest iPhone, he's got his own place, so I'm quite happy to hear that. So Randall was a drifter. I remember the very first time he came in and he walked in and he'd been in the store for 35 minutes and he was just maddening, you know, as those people are. And I'd asked Ralph, one of my coworkers, what do I do? And he said, oh, just walk up to them and say, can I help you with anything? So I did. And he turned around and he just looked, not at me, but through me and said, the holes are there. You just can't see them, but you've got to be careful because they can sneak up on you and snatch the air that you're trying to breathe. And I just went, okay. And that was the beginning. And he would pop in often at the most inopportune moments possible. He would often have this cherry red guitar and he would, they weren't quite songs, but he would sort of strum chords.
In the middle of the servo?
Yeah, he would walk around for about 2 hours with the cherry red guitar while customers came in. But he was, I don't know if he was religious, but he did know a lot of the Bible and he did go to church now and again. And he would sort of quote these passages from the Bible, but he would meld them with his own language, which when he was in a certain state, was impossibly eloquent. And as a writer, I just went, who and what are you exactly? He was incredibly addicted to nicotine. I've never seen anyone in my life more addicted to anything. And he had those massive dark splotches on his hands from the you know, the nicotine and the tar. And he would grind his teeth to a level that was so just enveloping that you had to stop everything you were doing. It was 17 hellish nails down a blackboard inside of your ear canal. So he was a mixed bag, but he was just beguiling, absolutely beguiling.
He sounds like quite a perfectly harmless guy for a start and really quite lovely and interesting. Do you remember any people who really frightened you, who came into the place, who made you fearful for yourself?
Again, the very first night I was working in Werribee, I named him Goliath. I never found out his real name.
Well, this is happening on your first night, was
yes.
it, in Werribee? Right.
I have a thing for first nights.
Was there a meeting in Werribee or something, and they said, this kid's starting, and let's go and give him a hard time?
I think I was fairly convinced that there was a rip in the space-time right. continuum somewhere very near my servo, like maybe behind the car wash. And from that void emerged creatures that defied explanation.
Orcs and
description.
And elves and yeah. hobbits. And, yeah.
Mm. Maybe if they'd been experimented under Area 51 for the past 30 years and they were chimeras of whatever. But yeah, that first night, this monster of a man, 6'6", half as wide, it seemed. He was wearing the classic sort of dark blue Aussie singlet. He had blood trickling down his neck from a cut. And he was just, like, his fist was as big as my head. And he had wet, dark hair. It was raining. And I'd forgotten to lock the door. I mean, I probably would have let him in anyway, but I would have been quite circumspect about it. But his eyes, they glinted like nuclear reactors or something. And he burst in and he just said, "Who says crime doesn't pay, hey, buddy?" And he just stared at me for about 5 seconds after he said it to gauge my reaction. I was like, "Oh, okay." And yeah, he sort of grabbed three of the toxic roast chicken rolls, the horrible things that I lived on for the first year that almost killed me, chucked them in the microwave, and then grabbed some soft porn and lit a cigarette, and then grabbed two Big M's, drained them, and then came up and just started leafing through the soft porn like we were old mates. It took me a while to realise, but he was on a lot of speed.
Was he trying to get a reaction from you, or was this just authentic stream of consciousness and he didn't care who was around him?
I think both. It was almost like he was doing both at the same time. That was, I suppose, the true, true baptism, although, you know, there were so many.
You write that servos seem to breed a particularly tough kind of female employee. Who are you thinking of when you say that?
So there was a woman named Nellie who I adore. How would I describe Nellie? A kind-hearted but take-no-shit woman from Serbia, masochistic, a definite streak of masochism, bulldog tough, but very, very down-to-earth person, I suppose, in a lot of ways. She would liberate plants in the servo grounds that she felt were being neglected and take them home. She was like one of my teachers. She was there, I think, almost from the very first day the servo opened, which was probably 10 years before I was there. She taught me how to stand up for myself above all else. But after she had been working in the servo for a while since I'd been there, she got divorced from her husband. And to help pay the settlement, she got a second job at a max security prison. And she said to me, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks after she started and she'd been through a training, she said, "David, do you know what?" In this thick Serbian accent, she said, "I have been working in this prison and I'm surrounded by the worst of the worst, you know, thugs, rapists, pedophiles, murderers. And you know what? I adore it compared to this servo. It is such a nice working environment compared to the servo." And I just said, "What?" She goes, "In the prison, the prisoners are decent human beings to me. When I come here, I'm treated like absolute dirt. And here," as she sort of showed me, "here, we're the ones in jail. We're the ones in the cage." And I went, that's a good point.
I've seen people in servos who work in servos be treated hideously by customers to the point where you're almost going to say something. You kind of worry that they're on crystal meth and they might hit you or something like that. What is that? What's going on there? Why do people who work in servos, who are just doing their jobs as best they can, cop abuse like that on minimum wage too? Why is all this rage directed at the servo worker?
So my theory at this point is road rage multiplied by high petrol prices, multiplied by the intensity of the colours and the sound of the store. And then you look at the other side, which is what's going on in these people's lives. And obviously you can't know, but if there's any place that you're going to let fly, it's going to be somewhere that is massively stimulating to your amygdala and, you know, parts of your prefrontal cortex. You're going to, this is the time to let go. So that's my theory.
See, my theory was that the reason why a servo is so brightly lit, and who hasn't walked into a 7-Eleven or a servo after a big night going, "Oh, God," and hating the bright lights. My theory, I suppose, was that the reason why you have these bright halogen lights is that it's supposed to induce a kind of sobriety in the customers. Is that the case, or is there another reason why the lights are so bright at 3 a.m. in a servo surrounded by all this technicolor junk?
I would say it's like the casino. And in some ways, a servo is very much like a casino. If you think about, let's say you have a boys or a girls weekend in Vegas, and, you know, you drop $3,000 gambling and you're like, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And I think in a microcosmic sense, the servo is like a Vegas in that you go in and there's the bright lights and the bright sounds and all of the pleasures and so on and so forth. And you go up to the console and they're trying to shill you stuff. And it's like, "Come on, take those two cherry ripes for $5. And it's like, "Oh, I'll take them." And what happens in the servo stays in the servo.
Oh, that's how you get permission to walk in and have a hot chicken hero, a couple of cherry ripes and an energy drink.
Yeah, because it's so fleeting. It's so temporal in the sense that it's this bright, insane, almost clown-like box of colours And you're going in there to feed your compulsions and your addictions and your desires. So, you know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever been to Amsterdam. Mm. Have you ever been into that middle part of the red light district, how it condenses into this sort of square where you walk around and that's where the best looking women are and they're all in their red lit windows. And it's like that part is almost like the servo, because you're just looking and everywhere is abundance and desire. And you're thinking, I could have that, I could have that, and I could have that. Whatever it is, it's instant gratification and it's allowed because it's accepted. That's a part of Australia and the rest of the world.
Officially, you're not an employee of the corporation that runs the servo. You're a team member, aren't you?
Yes, you are. I use quite a few metaphors relating to communist Russia because I felt that that was quite apt.
So it's like comrade.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, comrade.
Goodwin, yeah.
You will work harder and you will help us achieve our five-year plan for the glory of the servo because you love Mother Servo and you are committed to Mother Servo. And if you aren't, well, watch out. You know, like it was that very duplicitous, passive-aggressive, top-down, isn't it all great that we're team members now? Do this and do it quickly and don't get any drive-offs.
Drive-off. Now, that's when someone takes off, having loaded up their car with petrol and having not paid for it. I didn't really think that was really possible anymore because those forecourts are covered in surveillance cameras. They can take a snapshot of your license plate, maybe even your rego sticker, and they can find you eventually. But that's still a thing people drive off?
Oh, huge. I think I was reading the other week about 70 to 80 million a year. It's different in the US, which is interesting. They have tire spikes and they have jail terms, which I think is what you need, quite frankly. I mean, I understand with what the cost of living is these days and the cost of petrol, it's not exactly easy for people who aren't earning much money.
Yeah, but are they the people who are doing the drive-offs or is it more like, I don't know, teenagers or something like that?
Where I was working in Werribee, it was definitely young people. Like if you see someone pull up in a hoodie, if you see someone pull up not really looking at the Bowser as they're pumping, obviously if they're using premium unleaded, but most of all, and keep in mind this was 15 years ago, if they were driving a VN Commodore, that was the key.
Why the VN Commodore?
I don't know. I don't know what it was. I called it Satan's Chariot. My biggest theory was, here's a cheap car with, I can't remember, I think it was a 3.6 litre, but there were
a lot of engine power.
Special editions were, five litre. But, you know, V6 or a V8, and it's very powerful and it can scream away from petrol pumps, you know, in the blink of an eye. But it just attracted a certain kind of person. I think cars are like that, you know. How often have people been cut off by a BMW, although not as much these days? You know, you've probably seen the meme where it says, you think your job is useless. What about the guy that installs indicator lights on BMWs? You know, yeah, that's just what you think of when you see people in certain cars. So there was just something about that car. But yeah, look, drive-offs, there were two kinds. There was the obvious classic drive-off, which we're talking about. But then there was what we would call an insufficient funds drive-off. So you fill up and then you've forgotten your wallet, or you fill up and your significant other's spent money that you thought you had, or they were generally the two ones. But some people would just fill up and, oh, I don't have a wallet. I'm like, don't have a card. I'm like, well, okay. So that was difficult. And that was the one they really tried to crack down on.
And what are the consequences for you as an employee if for a drive-off or someone hasn't paid for fuel? Does that come out of your pocket or are you punished?
Never out of my pocket. They never did that. Again, it was like Soviet Russia in that you would sort of hear on the grapevine that you were not in the good books of the people above, but it was cumulative. And once you got a couple, and it didn't matter whether it was your fault or not, obviously, as they got worse, we had to write down every number plate. But if anyone had half a brain, you're not using your number plate when you're doing a drive-off. You're obviously going to steal plates. But quite often people would come to fill up, like regular customers, in the morning on the end of my shift. And I wouldn't authorize the pump because they didn't have a number plate. And they'd come storming in going, what the hell are you doing? Why aren't you authorizing my pump? I've been coming here for 5 years. I said, mate, you haven't got plates. And he's like, don't be freaking stupid. And then I get them to turn around and they're like, what the? So it would happen quite often. A console operator had a car pull up and they did a drive off and he wrote down the number plate. And about An hour later, he got a call from the cops, the console operator, and they're saying, well, why don't you think you should pay for your petrol, mate? And he said, what are you talking about? And they'd stolen the console operator's plates off his car in the car park and then done a drive-off. And the console operator, you know. So obviously evolution and all, people get smarter. But with the cameras, they would always say, no, it's up to you. But they never invested in those level of cameras. It was always, what can we do for the cheapest amount possible while losing the least amount of money, while making the most amount of money on everything in the store?
You write that you tried using speed for a while to stay awake. Obviously, that was going to have consequences at some point and make working on speed not a very good idea.
It would have been, a year. I can't remember how far in. But, one of my puffy jacketed drug dealers walked in and bought, his three magazines of porn and his seven, I think he bought a carton of cigarettes a week, whatever. And, he just said, you need some help, bro, putting those boxes away. He just said, here you go, have a bit of this. It's on the house. And I was like, okay. And, gave it a shot. And I think I got the 2 ton of stock put away in about an hour as opposed to 4. And then I just started writing. And it was just nonsense, sort of stream of consciousness stuff.
Seemed really good at the time, though, I'm sure.
I was convinced it was Kerouacian, and then went home and didn't sleep very much, and then went to work the next night and felt terrible. But I didn't try speed very often. It wasn't really my favourite drug. I quickly got onto MDMA, and that was the one that opened my eyes and actually had some repercussions that weren't great, but also did a lot for me in regards to, childhood trauma and stuff like that. I got to work through so many things. And I think now that we're seeing that it's being worked in psychotherapy and it's being approved for, PTSD and stuff like that. But eventually, obviously, it became too much. I'll say the nadir was when I worked on probably about 200 mics of acid. That was a shift that made me realize that drugs and work probably weren't going to work.
Was that done with intent or just an accident? You'd taken it and then went, oh, God, I've got to go to work.
No, I took it knowing I had work. I probably had about the first 4 hours in the city clubbing, and then I went, oh, that's right, it's time for work. But I sort of knew, and I was kind of curious if I could do it.
In this ultra bright, ultra colourful environment.
Some customers that were a bit more cluey had an idea I was definitely on something, but during that stage I was on something quite often.
And then you tried mindfulness for a while.
I did. I went to Europe to decompress for a couple of months, had a fantastic time actually in the sun and eating and being up during the day, and then came back and I was just depressed because I was like, I don't want whinging bogans. I want worldly Europeans and tall frosty beers and espressos in town squares and stuff like that. So I was quite depressed and I needed to do something. And around that time I read Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, and it floored me. Its rationale was just so simple but so revelatory.
What does this mean? You're sitting there like focusing on a spider's web in the servo or what?
Well, what it made me realize was essentially what he said, that, the past is gone, it will never exist. The future is never going to come because it's always now. And I went, well, yeah, it makes sense. And then I stopped and I went, oh my God, this has huge repercussion for how I could live my life. And then from that, I started to learn to meditate.
But can you work in a servo and meditate while you're working in a servo?
If you're working nights, without question. I started by staring at the Slurpee machines because that endless slow swirl that's almost like a torus.
Like a yin-yang almost.
Yeah, exactly. Of sweet, frosty goo. I don't know. There was something about it that just spoke to me at a deeper level. And I stood there for the better part of an hour. The first time I really sunk into it, I just got to the point fairly quickly. And I was quite surprised how quickly. It was like my brain and body and spirit were just crying out for it. And then I was just like, oh my God, this is so nice. And I just turned into this agreeable monk that was just so at ease and at peace.
And while you're doing that in your console behind the anti-jump wires, you're meditating, having that lovely feeling. Some guy, say, walks up and goes, give me a packet of Winnie Blues. Yep. Does that hush your mellow at that time, or does something else go wrong?
What I'm actually thinking at that point is, I wonder what's going on inside that guy's head and moreover in his life that has made him into this person. Like, what armor is he wearing where he thinks that he needs to be belligerent and he needs to do this and so on and so forth?
So this is Buddhist detachment now you have.
Essentially, it was very Buddhist, yeah.
This whole life sounds like it has a strange, faintly sinister kind of gravity to it, like it keeps, like drags you into a gravity well or something.
Completely.
How did you crawl out of that gravity well eventually?
Oh, God. Through writing. As the years went by and I continued working, I started thinking, well, okay, I'm mid-20s. What am I going to do with my life? I ended up going to uni, back to uni to do advertising and marketing, which I thought was kind of, you know, still fit me. And I managed to graduate this time just on not very much sleep again. And then I, as soon as I finished that, I went, I don't think I want to do this. You know, I love the creative part of advertising, but I'm not really interested in. So I just wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I meditated and I meditated and I meditated. And slowly, as I drove home with my pockets, you know, crinkling full of these long register receipt snakes, I would go to sleep and then I would wake up and I would sort of attempt the folly of, I don't know, shaping them into some kind of discernible narrative. And I always said that I was very blessed. I don't know if you've ever read a book called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil by John Berendt. And he said in interviews afterwards, I was so blessed. This was a book set in Savannah and had all the crazy characters of Savannah. And I was like him, except it was a microcosm and it was more condensed. And I was just so blessed to have these people walk in through the auto doors.
So you had that material, but why did you leave? Why aren't you working there now? What makes you finally walk away from that weirdly toxic job?
There were a few things. I realized I had to get out because I had to do something else, because it's like in Good Will Hunting when Ben Affleck says to Matt Damon, I'll wake up tomorrow and I'll be 50 and I'll still be doing this shit. And I felt like that. I had that moment and I went, I've got to stop this. So I saved and I saved and I saved. I met a girl and she was kind of like my twin and we got on really well. She was a writer. She had a retail job and we just clicked completely. And she was moving to London and she said, why don't you come? And why don't you live there? Because my father was British, so I had a British passport. And I just thought, yeah, why not? So slowly, bit by bit, I just went, yeah, I'm going to quit. Yeah, I'm going to quit. And then 4 months went by. Yeah, I'm going to quit. Yeah, I'm going to quit. And meanwhile, I was squirreling away all my nuts for the winter. And yeah, I quit eventually and walked out into the sunshine. And I'd like to say I never looked back, but... A year later, I was back at freaking servos.
Oh, no, but, no, really, yeah, really.
I was overseas and the global financial crisis was still happening and I just couldn't really get any job that I wanted. So I went back to Australia and like a dog to its fresh spew, I returned to the night. This was a different servo, different company. It was like this one was a big truck stop on the edge of the freeway that still had a lot of speed-addled truck drivers, but wasn't as insane as the other one. Yeah, I did about 5 years there.
How long altogether did you end up doing working in a servo?
11 to 12. I think 12 years all up. So, yeah, I did those 6 years, somehow got by, and then I sold everything I owned and moved to Nimbin, where my parents had moved up to not long before. So I sold my house, sold everything I owned, and moved to Nimbin about 2 months later.
Just finally, David. The servo and the 7-Eleven, the convenience shop, they destroyed the corner shop, the mixed business, the deli, is whatever they're called in whatever particular city. Every city has their own name for these shops. They no longer really exist anymore. Mm. They sort of sucked all the business away from those things. But now there are EVs, and increasingly people will have EVs. They're taking off like gangbusters all over the world. We'll charge them probably at home or in the street or somewhere like that. Is the servo doomed to die like the old Blockbuster video stores?
I can't give you a complete answer because I, like most people, I don't know. I think that it's fairly obvious that EVs are looking like the future. And if it's not EVs, it's going to be some new technology that supersedes them. So unless we can come up with ways to hypercharge a vehicle very quickly, I don't know how the servo survives beyond that, unless they just take the pumps away and it's your little corner store. But then without the petrol, why are you going there? So that was always the thing. You don't go there to pay ridiculous amounts for, you know, incredibly unhealthy, overpriced crap. You know, it just, unless it's 3 a.m. and nothing else is open. But then so many supermarkets are now 24/7 and they're usually just next door. So I really don't know, but I, like you, I mourn the loss of the milk bar, the corner store. You know, there was something, it's almost sepia tone now. You look back at it and you just think, I wish that was still there.
Run know? By a lovely old Greek couple.
Exactly, yeah. Or even the angry old Greek woman that ran the fish and chip shop next door and hated all her customers, but you still went there because there was something about it. And you just went, yeah, you know. There was one near my place back when I used to live in Werribee that was just around the corner that's exactly like that. And she's still there. She's still hanging on.
She may outlast the servo.
I hope so.
Hang on, dear lady, hang on. It's been wonderful speaking with you, David. Thank you so much.
You too, Richard. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
It started with a Saturday lunch. It ended with three people dead. The suspected cause, allegedly poisonous mushrooms. The cook, Erin Patterson, has been charged with murder and attempted murder. She says she's innocent.
I'm devastated. I love them.
I'm Christian Silver, host of the new ABC podcast Mushroom Case Daily, the podcast that follows the case of Erin Patterson as it happens. And if and when it heads to a full trial, we'll be there daily. To be the first to hear updates, follow Mushroom Case Daily on the ABC Listen app.